Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the table. It's great to have everybody here. Pull up a chair. Let's get some coffee. Get a pop a top or some sweet tea down here in the South. Definitely some sweet tea. It's a hot one out, nice and muggy. But welcome to the table and the meeting of the Unknowing Minds. It's great to have everybody back. Last couple weeks, we've had some unbelievable guests. A couple weeks ago, we had Chris Schweitzer on, which was great. Last week, we had the voice of track and field in America in Mike J. So excited to have it. And today we've got two phenomenal, unbelievably well-known guests as well. We've got the longtime coach at Kennesaw State, now down at UTRGV in the Multi-Stars Track Club, Andy Agarth. And we've got Jordan Gray, the American record holder in the decathlon. I apologize, I almost rolled that all over. But before we get going, as always, my name is Matt Eshy, the head cross-country coach, associate head track coach at UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham. And guests with me today, it's always going to be fun. We'll start out, you know, Darren Flowers down at the UTRGV. How are we doing down there, Darren? You melting yet?
Every day.
What is it, about 110 down there right now? Who knows?
I think it felt like 104 yesterday. I'm sure it'll be about the same. So, yeah, excited to talk some multi-events today.
This is going to be something different for us, which I'm excited about. Oddly enough, the two of the multi-distance coaches jumped off, so we got all multis here today. This is going to be fun. We've got out of Nevada, the associate head coach Scott Williamson. You a little cooler than us?
You know, we're a little cooler. We're probably like 85 today is the high, but you know, about an hour and a half to the west over in Sacramento, they're supposed to be like 106, 107, like the rest of the week. So we're going to be happy with our 85. So
good night. I can't even fathom that, really, honestly.
Yeah. No humidity, so it's really nice. So,
yeah, up in the great Midwest, still hasn't changed his books. I don't think he's actually left the seat. He's probably just posted up right there and let the girlfriend do whatever he wants to do. But Coach Mike Erb out of Indiana University.
How's it going? Just happy to talk some multi-events and things like that. So this will be a little change of pace, which I'm looking forward to.
I bet. I'm going to be sitting back enjoying this one. And as always, holding down the fort. He changes locations every week. He made a bet from IKEA last weekend. I think it swallowed him up. But he is back on the podcast. Tom Sage of VCU. Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Not too bad. Looking forward to this one. And lastly on it, but not least, I think a little late jumping on the podcast this morning. I think he probably had a side session hanging out with a good friend of his, the Billiken, both bald. I mean, I figure they're probably either getting the head polished or something along those lines. he's making some stuff happen. John, how we doing, buddy?
Doing well. Out running some errands. So hopefully I don't get in a car wreck while I'm doing this.
We'll make sure we can't see you so you don't do that kind of stuff. As I mentioned earlier, to join us, we're excited to have him. I think he's got – oh, geez, Louise, I could probably go through this on the kind of stuff. But I think, 18-time Sun Coach of the Year. He's a two-time head coach of the South Region, if I'm not mistaken, as well. He's had four or five of his athletes be at the World Championships, or at least the U.S. Trials. He was actually at UAB a little bit. We'll talk about that for later in the podcast. He's now the multis and jumps coach at UTRGV, along with the head coach director of the Multi-Stars Track Club as well, Mr. Andy Agarth. How we doing, sir?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, it's exciting to have you and excited to see you back. And of course, one of your star pupils, but one who is easily, quickly risen to great fame, I guess, in USA Track and Field and in the world, of course. One of the best multi-eventers we have. We are very, very excited to have Jordan Gray back, or not back, excuse me, love to be back, but Jordan Gray on the podcast. We'll talk about her background in a little bit, but Jordan, appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. This is really exciting, and I'm excited to talk a little bit of multi-events with you.
Yeah, and we've said before, and I think it goes without saying, we've had some great distance runners on here. We've got a couple good distance runners. We've talked track and field, what we can do to change the meets. That's still one of our most popular podcasts we've ever heard. But change the meets, how do we make it more entertaining? How do we do things? I think that, you know, we've looked at the sprints, we've looked at the jumps, we've looked at the multis and the vaults and the distances, but, you know, but we've always left the decathlon, the multi-events, all that stuff has always been left out. And so we need to find ways to help bring that back into the spotlight. So hopefully you got some good ideas for us.
Amen.
I love it. The couple of things, we always like to do a quick little, you know, recap of the week in track and field. And I'll be honest, we jump overseas first. The one big thing I did see was the Monaco Diamond League coming up. The BBC has picked up the podcast. Or not podcast. We're on one. the live stream of the Monaco Diamond League. So that has given them the funding to be able to put the Monaco meet on, which is exciting because that's one of the best meets in the world. So that's going to be going on. I'm going to butcher his last name. Andrew. I'm butchering his last name. Andrew Pazzi, the 110 hurdler, set a world-leading 110 in going 1370, if I'm not mistaken, are the Paavo Nurmi Games. Kind of a pretty big deal right there. The Britain had a couple of U18 and U20 performances that were world-leading or at least up there in the world, so they're doing some things. So people are still doing some things. I know we got some sprints and jumps meets coming up, but there's so many little things around, I think it would take 10 to 20 minutes to actually do. But the one thing I know, as we all know, we won't dive into it because we could talk about it and not even talk to Andy and Jordan, and we want to talk to them. But the biggest news, of course, is yesterday there's 8 more conferences that shut down cross-country, causing the NCAA to cancel the championships. So unfortunately, the distance runners now, and not against anybody else, but distance runners now will have missed 3 national championships in a row, from indoors, outdoors, and cross-country. Again, I know they ran indoor track conference, but they did not run the national championship. So those 3 are out. And I was looking under the podcast earlier, realizing UAB and Conference USA is one of only 5 mid-majors still standing. There's 3 power fives now. So it's been a rough week and a sad week for track and field and for cross country in the NCAA. But you know what? We're still going. We got the multi-events specialists here, and this is going to be a lot of fun. But Andy, let's start with you. You know, as I said, 18-time Sun Coach of the Year. Started out at UAB for 3 years. I'm correct on that, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And then you go to Kennesaw State. You built what Kennesaw State is today. Tell us a little bit about how you got to UAB, because I believe you're in Bemidji State. Am I correct on that?
Yep.
How in the world do you go from Minnesota and Bemidji State all the way down to Birmingham? And people ask me the same question, being from Wisconsin, coming all the way down to how do you do that? Go up, move over, and now, you know, you got to put up with Darren Flowers and, you know, one of our panelists. Like, how do you do that?
Well, that's the best part at the end there. But I was an athlete at Bemidji, which is a Division II school. You know, love the sport of track and field. Knew I wanted to continue in, you know, as a coach. So I was lucky enough to get a graduate assistant position at Syracuse University. I was out there for a couple of years. Met Cable Tolbert and got plugged in with some of his mentors, you know, Dan and Boo and some of those guys. Yep. Which really helped kind of kick my career off and my knowledge and save some athletes some heartaches.
I can only imagine.
But from there, I applied for about 85 coaching positions before I got a call back. And it was a call back from a D3 who was wondering why I didn't have distance experience. And so I wasn't hired for that one, even though I had experience with everything else.
Okay.
But waited. It ended up being in January. Ray Stanfield, who's a head coach at UAB, gave me a call. And he had hired somebody, and it didn't work out for whatever reason. So he went through the resumes that he already had, and he was basically looking for a decathlete. He kind of wanted somebody that could coach everything because he was, you know, doing the distance. Mm-hmm. And we had Jennifer Robeson kind of doing the high jump and the hep a little bit. They were paying a little over $12,000, and I was like, I'm in. Let's go.
$12,000. Wow.
Yeah, but it got my foot in the door, which is what I needed, you know?
Yeah.
Moved down there, coached there for 3 years. Was able to move up a little bit, but I was still plenty well under 30 grand and, you know, wanted to continue advance, not just, you know, with more pay, but also to continue learning and growing. So got the opportunity to go and coach with Cliff Revelto in Kansas State, and I was there for about 4.5 years. And, you know, another just tremendous mentor who's really advanced my career decades. You know, my knowledge, not only of the sport, but, or not only, you know, the coaching aspects, the technical aspects, but also how to manage and run a program. And again, you know, trying to continue and grow. Moved on to Kennesaw and was, you know, fortunate to have a good staff around me and a lot of great athletes. And, you know, able to have success there because of what they did largely. And after being there 8 years, and I mean, you kind of said some of the accomplishments, you know, I felt like, I'm always a person that's driven and motivated and trying to grow and trying to improve. And, you know, I just kind of felt like it kind of leveled out with what could be done there. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of keeping my eyes open, looking around, you know, what could be the next good opportunity to continue, you know, just growing and advancing. And, wasn't necessarily seeing something, but a new administration came in at the same time, and you know, they were on a little bit more of a regional cut things back just a little bit, whereas on this growth mindset, and you know, it just wasn't quite clicking. So that was a good impetus to go ahead and step aside and just focus on the post-collegiate guys I was working with. Actually formed the Multistars Incorporation as a nonprofit corporation to be able to help serve the combined event community. Did that just largely because of, you know, love for the athletes and for the sports, but you know, wasn't making too much money off of it, as you know.
Yep.
But so, you know, Darren offered me a great opportunity to be able to get back in the NCAA scene and, you know, work with the jumpers and combined eventers here. And it's a blast. And still able to continue helping the post-collegiates. So it's really a great setup. And I'm really blessed.
Did you bring that whole Multistars thing down with you then?
Yeah, kind of. Jordan had come with, and Lindsay Schwartz joined in. Solomon Simmons had just gotten married, and so they initially decided that they were going to stay a little bit closer to his wife's family. But he contacted me about a month ago, and just feels that, you know, we're a better fit coach-athlete relationship and everything. And so he's going to be moving here September 1st and crank it back up towards the games.
That's going to be a lot. I mean, that's some firepower sitting down there in the valley. I mean, that's.
And this is something that I'm really excited about too. And one thing that I pitched to Andy and what we wanted to build here and something they've never really had is a combined event culture.
Yeah.
And so like just seeing what he's done in his history and the group of athletes that were going to come down with him, I said, what a perfect opportunity for us to take a step forward in the combined events and really build a combined event culture here. And I think we can have a lot of success. So really, really feel blessed that, you know, Andy and his group and Jordan are down here working.
And you've always talked about that being when you build a program to, you know, go the distance route, but then also possibly just go the multis route because there's so much there. And the multis are, again, so versatile. And that's the first thing you think of a multi-athlete is somebody who is versatile. As a distance runner, sometimes you think of a versatile athlete and you're like, oh, they play soccer, basketball, and they run.
Well, I mean, you're talking to a guy, you know, Andy, who built a program, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, and this would be my kind of my second build coming from West Texas and then here at UTRGV. But, man, I truly believe, like, in the field events is, to me, it's where you start. That's just my philosophy. And I feel like then you go from there.
Well, and you even look at what Petros did at UGA. I mean, he almost pulled off a national championship.
Exactly.
With nothing on the track.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No, very true. They happen to have the drops, which helped out a little bit, but everything else is almost right there.
Right.
What's the, it's always curious on this kind of stuff. You know, you're dealing with some young studs, you 17, 18 year olds that you're dealing with at UTRGV, but then you're also dealing with the Solomon Simmons and Jordan Grays of the world, which are now, you know, they're out, they're world-class athletes. They're looking for U.S. championships, trials, and not just championships, but medals, you know, and go on one further. What's the biggest difference between dealing with both?
I think the biggest difference, I mean, like the post-collegians, it's really difficult because they have to survive, right? They have to live, they have to work a job. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily good to not have a job at all because you need some structure to your life if you're just sleeping in every day. You know, I think that can be difficult for, you know, first-year post-collegians can be, you know, equally challenged to not have any structure. So I think having something going on, but, you know, to be able to get the recovery, I think that's almost the most challenging part. You know, they've built up that engine, right? They've got so much horsepower that it's easy to tear the wheels up. You know, so to be able to get the chiropractic or the masseuse or, you know, whatever, that type of stuff, but to not have really money to do that and to be trying to work a job just to be able to live, I think that's the challenge, is just that balance of you know, being able to support yourself and being able to take care of, you know, business, you know, track-wise and recovery-wise, whereas the collegiate athletes have a little bit more, you know, set up. Obviously, we're able to schedule, you know, practice around class times, and they've got the athletic trainers there to kind of help take care of them. But also, their engines aren't as big yet, right? So they're not tearing themselves up as significantly. And, you know, with having a scholarship, you know, that type of thing, or a little bit more parental support, sometimes, you know, they don't have to worry. And obviously, a lot of them are working part-time jobs, but they don't have to work a full-time job to live.
Mm-hmm. Where have you guys, you know, you're coming after this multis crew with UTRGV, and I'll let you plug them, you know, UTRGV a little bit too. Where do you look for your athletes? Is it just somebody down in the valley down there? Is it Texas? Or do you have to go everything from international to California, the Canucks? Where do you go?
Well, definitely looking all over. We'll look across the world, but of course, you know, each school has their niche of financial aid packages and different stuff like that. So we want to take advantage of really everything. You know, there's the in-state potential tuition breaks, you know, based on family income, and you know, the outstate, you know, being able to do outstate waivers, things like that. But, you know, I think we can get a lot of people from the north that want to come down. It's amazing to me. You know, I'd never really had a prejudice or an opinion of the area before looking into it. As I talk to a lot of people, there's fear of safety or human trafficking or you know, just crime being close to Mexico. And like, I've seen zero crime. When I look at the crime statistics of the university, it's way lower than many, if not most other universities. So I think some of the Texas or people that are a little bit more around is just trying to kind of overcome that prejudice so they understand that, you know, this is a great place. But sometimes that makes it a little bit easier recruiting from the north because, as you know, being from Wisconsin, me from Minnesota, like to go down to palm trees is pretty sweet.
You don't have to worry about the snow, the ice. You can just have a, you know, we're just talking, I was just talking to another coach on another line about, yeah, you know, how about we have a cross-country championships in the middle of winter? And we're like, there's no way in God's green earth we can do that because Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa, mm-hmm. they all have that snow and ice. And
right.
That's normally the built-in off-season is that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. Missouri, who knows what happens in Missouri, but you have all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you come down to the palm trees and the warm. I think our at UAB, our cross-country team's got a girl from Colorado, Illinois, and two out of New Hampshire. You know, I mean, they all wanted to get out of the snow and wanted to come down somewhere they could train year round. And when it's, you know, when it's January, as you guys know, and it's 55 degrees, 60 degrees. Whew.
Exactly.
There's no questions about that.
Hey, Andy, could you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that a lot of, say, collegiate athletes go into the post-collegiate scene face as far as even like finding a group, access to training, just some of those things that you've experienced over the last few years?
Yeah, I think one of the hard things is losing the team aspect, right? I mean, we get so much focus, you know, through the collegiate system on conference championships, NCAA championships, that type of thing. And yeah, there's a national championship, but there's kind of something bigger than yourself when you're on the collegiate team. Whereas as soon as you leave that, like, although it's an individual sport, you still lose that team aspect. And I think it can be, the motivation kind of wane a little bit, especially if you don't have other people that are on kind of the same training cycle, the same annual plan, the same championships in mind. You know, it's, you don't need other people there to train, you know, just physically. But I think mentally it makes it just more enjoyable. It makes it more competitive. It helps you just have that motivation, that challenge going towards those competitions at the end of the year to keep that high quality of training. So I've definitely seen, you know, if you're not kind of plugged in with the group, it can be really hard to stay afloat. And then I think, you know, one way or the other with the structure thing, if you have a situation where you don't have to have a job, but now you kind of have no structure to life and you're spending most of your day laying around or whatever that is, you know, it can be really hard for the body to adapt because we're such cyclical beings. You know, so if you lose kind of that cycle of having a schedule, I think, you know, a lot of athletes will struggle with that, or the opposite, where they're trying to make some money, and whether that's trying to kind of start their career and try to be a full-time athlete, or if they're trying to kind of scramble with jobs because they know they can't fully invest in their career if they want to be a professional athlete. So they're trying to scramble with various jobs that aren't paying very well, but still having the flexibility of time off to be able to, you know, train when you need to and travel to competition, all those type of things. So you might have some structure in that schedule, but you have the challenges obviously as well. So those are really kind of the biggest things that I've seen, as well as, of course, you know, some colleges are great and they'll let post-collegiates take advantage of the sports medicine, some of that type of thing. But, you know, sometimes they're just totally on their own. I mean, you get injured and it's up to you to go see a doctor or, you know, find your own masseuse and pay that out of pocket and find your chiro and you know, your modalities, yeah. All those type of things. So, you know, definitely it's, I wish more collegiate athletes understood and appreciated everything that they have at their disposal. Because, you know, most pros don't have that, at least not initially, until they're, you know, getting some medals.
How many, you guys, you guys will know this question better than I, and I think the distances are more, the groups, the professional groups are more pronounced throughout the country. How many multi-groups like this are there? Can you think of any?
Probably three or four.
Yeah, okay. That's what I would say is three or four.
Where are they at? Help me out here a little bit. Honestly, I'm asking because I'd like to know.
Yeah, we have Santa Barbara Track Club. Did you hear that? I think we were talking at the same time.
No, say that again, please. Yeah.
Santa Barbara Track Club.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a big one. And then, Mike Young has a group out in North Carolina, the athletic lab.
Okay.
And then obviously I'm trying to kind of get something going. And since it's bad timing, because just when I kind of got it started, COVID and everything was hitting. So it's hard to kind of get people to come and get this thing off the ground. But, we've got a small group here. And then I think there's, a little bit of hit or miss, other places. I'm probably forgetting somebody who I shouldn't be at. Jordan, is there any other group that you can think of offhand?
Well, like down in Jacksonville, they've got some people.
Yeah, there's a couple people with the Jacksonville Athletic Club, a couple people doing the deck there. I think Sheila Burrell has a couple down at San Diego. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that there's any big groups. The biggest ones are probably Santa Barbara for sure, and then Chris Mack, obviously, at the training center.
Yeah. I just never knew that question. And it might be an interesting, dumb question, but I would love to try and learn more about everything going on. And I don't know how many people listening know that there's at least one group, if not four or five groups.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, Andy, I'm sure you see what's going on with, right now with limited competition, but more like concentrated focus with competitions and things like that. And you see these groups that are real prominent, Bowerman and some of these other groups that are putting on these events, throws events, vaults events. How do you think we move forward with combined events? Because I know for me personally, I just love the combined events. I think they're incredible. I think they're a great representation of what track and field is. And how do you think that we maybe promote the combined events better and move those forward?
Well, the challenge is time, right? I mean, we only have so much attention span. And when the event is taken 8 hours a day for 2 days, it's hard to get, a lot of fans out there. It's amazing, though. You go over to Europe and a lot of the combined event challenge meets or even, the Thorpe Cup, those type of things, lots of them, they're along the fans right down there next to the athletes. And obviously they have them back just a little bit, but they're not stuck in the stands. They can get right down there by the shot put or by the high jump or whatever that is. And I mean, they're within a few meters of the athletes and they can get so much more involved in the process. And, granted it might be 100 fans or a couple hundred fans is not a ton, but when they're right there in the area, it's bringing the energy up in that area. So the whole stadium isn't full, like it could be for, a Diamond League meet or that type of thing. But you can get great energy for the event and for the athletes. And I think the fans, they're more engaged because, they're right there. It's being courtside at a basketball game. So I think that's one thing that's definitely valuable. The challenge, of course, like I say, is time of how long it takes to do the combined events. But, there's definitely people that have a love for it and an interest in it. So I think even, NCAA championships, U.S. championships, if instead of just showing a 30-minute clip of the winner of a few of their events, if they had, just even streaming online, then, it wouldn't even have to be, the television coverage, but, cover each of the athletes and each of the events. And, if you're editing that, obviously it doesn't have to be a super long clip. But I mean, you could get a lot of coverage there and grow the interest in the combined events. But, definitely challenge, not having it in the Diamond League, that type of thing. There's very little money out there for combined event athletes. And that's one of the challenges is, if you look at most sprinters, they're going to hit their peak around 24, 25 years old, and they might be able to hold that for a few years, but I mean, they're not really getting better. Whereas combined eventers, usually it's 28 to 30 is when they're hitting their peak and then holding it, to maybe 32, somewhere in that type of range. So it takes a lot longer, but when there's no money in the sport, it's very difficult to, keep combined eventers in it long enough for them to be able to really hit their peak. So, and that's part of the reason that I started the Multi-Stars Track Club is to really try to serve that community because I do have a passion for it and try to give them the opportunity to stay in the sport longer and try to make it affordable, as much as I can possibly help them.
It's a great thing that you're doing to be able to help those people out because everybody, every little bit, even nonprofit, no matter what it is, if we can move the sport forward, that's the best thing to be able to do. And I love what you're doing. It's great and it's selfless. And so it's a tremendous, tremendous thing. So don't stop with that. But I think we got to bring her in here eventually. She's been tripping a little bit. Everyone, we can't just let her sit on the sidelines. Jordan, again, thanks for having you here. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm super excited for this. This is awesome.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Jordan, Kennesaw State alum, worked with Coach Eggerth over there for a long time, and then turned around. She won the ASUN championship in 19. She was second indoors in the NCAAs, I believe. Am I correct on this?
Yep. And
finished seventh outdoors.
Twice.
Good point. Thank you. But then she turns around. And I'll let you go through on how the progression happened after that. But I know for a fact it ended up with a decathlon American record, which was actually what you break the – stood for, what, 19 years? You broke it by almost 400 points, roughly. Am I correct on this?
Yeah, I broke it by about 400 points. And it had been around for a while. I don't remember exactly how long. But it's been an official IAAF event for, gosh, like almost 20 years now. So it's been a little longstanding record there.
Okay, so – from Georgia, am I correct in this, right?
Yep.
You're from Georgia. One would say somebody who's this, who's done exactly what you've done and accomplished what you've done, you could say it was all because of Andy, but let's just say you've got the talent. So did you look at other schools? How did you get to Kennesaw State?
So I did lots of sports growing up. I mean, as soon as I could hold a bat, my dad made me play softball. I did gymnastics. I did taekwondo. I did lots of sports, and I was going to go to school on a basketball scholarship was my goal. And right before my senior year that summer, my mom was like, I think you would like track. I just want you to try it out. Like, let's just go see. And I was like, I don't really want to, but I'll do it if you really want to make me. And so I went and tried out, and my tryout for the Heat Track Club, which is actually run by Blaine Williams. He's the dad of Kendall Williams and Devin Williams. And I went out there and he had me run three 500s with a girl who went to UGA to run the 800. And that was my tryout. And I died. Like the next day, my mom came to find me in bed and she's like, aren't you getting up? And I was like, I'm never moving again. This is a terrible sport. Why are you making me do this?
Yeah.
And, but that's kind of where it all started. And then my first day of track practice, I actually, I'd come from a basketball game. And I went up for a rebound and I got pushed and a girl sprained my ankle so bad it pulled a piece of the bone off. But I was like, we need to win this basketball game. So I didn't tell anyone. And then I sprained my other ankle. And so my coach was like, you weren't limping. And I was like, how could I limp on two sprained ankles? There's no foot to limp on.
That's a good point, really.
And so I showed up to practice in a boot and a brace. And Blaine was kind of like, well, you look kind of strong. So we'll teach you shot put and javelin. So they had me doing shot put and javelin, a boot and a brace. And then I came out and he was like, well, you're kind of fast and you can jump. So you're going to be a heptathlete. And I was like, cool. I have no idea what this is. I don't know how far it is around a track. I know nothing about what's going on. And so my first track meet ever was a heptathlon, like just straight from the get-go, senior year. And I fell in the hurdles. I got 2 points for the hurdles. Literally two. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I finished. Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
I was just like 0.3 seconds away from getting no points at all. And so that was my introduction to the heptathlon, was just straight from the get-go. And other people were like, oh, I do the shot put. And I was like, and what else? Like, not all of you people do this? Like, I thought the heptathlon was a thing. Like, we just all do track and field. Like, what do you mean you do one event?
Yeah.
And so I went to college at Kennesaw, mainly because I'm a very detailed person. I like to have things organized. I like to know what the plan is. I need understanding. And Andy, the first, like I walked in and he just had this bookshelf of like endocrinology, kinesiology, biomechanics, and like all this stuff. And I was like, that's awesome. And he's like, this is how we do annual plans. This is my binder of whatever. And I was like, this is great. And then he was also like, I have a bus that goes to church on Sunday every day. And I was like, this is the school we're going here. So yeah, it was just the best experience coming there. And then, you know, even when I got into school, I still pretty much had no idea what was going on. So Andy'd be like, we're doing this, we're going to do this drill, and we're going to go through the exchange zone. And everyone's like, okay. And I was like, yeah, got it. And he'd turn around and I'd look at someone and be like, help me. I have no idea. So yeah, that was kind of my intro into the heptathlon in college at Andy.
So you essentially, when you get on the track and Andy's like, all right, here's what you do with the exchange zones, you're like, okay, are those exchange zones colored? Because I want to make sure this is actually easier for me.
I literally didn't even know what that meant. The first time he said it, he was like, we're going to go around. You're going to do stuff in the exchange zone. I was like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we do colored exchange zones now. I would not just go to that color, just from there to there. That's all you That's the best color. So you progress extremely well. Hit your senior year at, you know, Kennesaw, hit the championships. So you go from the championships to, what'd you do after you finished NCAA Outdoors in 19?
In 2019, after I finished NCAA Outdoors, I went to do the women's decathlon. Okay. And so, yeah, it was an amazing experience. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything specific you want me to talk about the women's decathlon.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit where you learned to pole vault in all of this.
That's a good question, Scott. How did you pole vault?
Okay, so my freshman year indoor, I went to go find a teammate who had run away after the hurdles in the pentathlon for God knows what reason. And I went to go find her, and I was in high jump spikes, and I fell down a flight of stairs, and I broke a rib. I knocked multiple out. I tore my right adductor. Like, I looked like a cartoon character falling down the stairs. And because of this, I had to redshirt my outdoor season. I finished the pentathlon. I won gold, but then I was, like, dead. Yeah. And, yeah, everyone complains about the 800, and you should try to run an 800 with a broken rib. It hurts way worse. Yeah. And so I had to redshirt. So I got to just go watch and help outdoor. I didn't actually compete my freshman year. And so I was watching pole vault, and I walked over to Andy, and he's like, you're going to get on like a 14.7, 130, you know, and talking to people. And I was like, I'm going to learn this event. You're going to teach it to me. And I want to be a pole vaulter. And he was like, no. And I said, yes, I am going to learn to pole vault. And I was like, I'm going to learn what these mean. I'm going to learn about pole sizes. And Andy turned to one of the guy decks, just being stupid and silly. He was like, yo, Jordan wants to learn about pole sizes. And everyone started laughing because it was funny. And I was like, y'all can make as many jokes as y'all want as long as somebody teaches me how to pole vault. And so like that next spring, I was getting done with the practice and I was really tired. And Andy came over and he was like, okay, the decathletes have pole vault today, so if you want to come try and pole vault, you are welcome to. And I was like, I am so dead. I am so tired, but if I don't go do this, you will never let me try again. And so from that day on, I pole vaulted.
How in 2 weeks, you learn how to pole vault, but how in 2 weeks do you go ready from a hep to a deck? 3 weeks roughly after your championships. How do you get ready for that?
I mean, it's mostly maintaining. Like, you can't really obviously go through a whole new cycle of up and down. You kind of have to recover. You can come back up a little bit. Like, you kind of had a moderate week. But it wasn't really anything super, like, difficult to get ready. It was just kind of like, okay, we're going to keep training. Like, we're going to treat this like outdoor conference to NCAAs kind of thing. Like, we're just going to take a little break. We're going to come back up a little bit and then just kind of peak you for the outdoor meet.
I'm wondering, where was this idea born? As far as like, okay, I can do this. I can maybe go for an American record.
Yep.
Start focusing on that.
So like my junior year. So the thing with Andy is Andy's like very like whatever, but if you whine for about a year, he gives in. And so I whined about pole vault. And being able to do pole vault. And then it looked like I was going to have to do discus for a conference championship because he was like, you could probably go chuck it and get us some points. So he started kind of teaching me discus. And that was around my junior year. And I was like, y'all bet. I know all the events. Like, why do we even do the heptathlon? Let's do the deck. And Andy said, no. And I was like, yes, I'm going to do the deck. Same way I do a pole vault. And I kind of said I was going to do pole vault or going to do the decathlon. And around my senior year, about 2 years later, we learned about the women's decathlon, but I wasn't going to be able to do it that year. And so, for various reasons. And so we kind of like had it on the radar, and then Andy kind of started doing numbers. He's like, okay, like if you do the women's decathlon, you could probably at least get the American record, one day get the world, like let's kind of go after this and train you like a deck. And so kind of from that day on, like about junior, senior year, I didn't train as a heptathlete. I trained as a decathlete.
Yeah. So that's really where it started. I guess I should have phrased my question better. Of how did that come about? And Darren was 100% right. you knew about it. And I think you come down to it. You pretty much don't take no. And Andy pretty much has to get in. Cause I've heard a couple of times when Andy doesn't want me to do this. No, there's no way in hell I am this. This is what it is. Andy, is that about right?
Oh, she's very stubborn.
Well, there are some things like that, you know, we were not allowed to be late for things in college. Like I can remember my sophomore year because I was still getting used to this track thing. Like we had to do tempo running because we had weightlifting at 5:45 in the morning and you had to be there like 5:40. And we had to do tempo running before that. And so it was like 5 a.m. one time. It was like 40 degrees outside. And me and some girls didn't do it because we were like, it's way too cold to go do this. And later that day, Andy was like, did you all do your tempo running? And we were like, no, because it was 5 a.m. and 40 degrees. And that's way too cold. And he was like, I used to run and my eyelashes would freeze together. And we were like, never mind. We will get this done, sir. So he's lenient on some things, but definitely not all.
So Jordan, moving forward, you know, obviously, you know, at the USA and national level and stuff, the heptathlon is, you know, to make teams and stuff like that. That's kind of the event. But, you know, kind of what's your future look like for, like, are you trying to go after the world record in the decathlon? And kind of what's your thoughts kind of balancing the two?
Yeah, so I'm definitely going after the world record in the women's decathlon and then trying to get it to be more recognized by the Olympic Committee, because let's be honest, it's basically just a bunch of old white men that think our uterus will fall out if we try. And so like, and there's a lot of reasons, you know, kind of to, you know, make that not happen. Basically, like there's a lot of reasons you could argue against letting the women do the decathlon, but in my opinion, frankly, like every time you're going for equality, there's growing pains, right? Like when women were allowed to do the marathon, finally, like a lot of women, like I never want to do a marathon, but I support the fact that women should be able to do the marathon. And, really? You know, we had to learn about training cycles. We had to learn about, we had to have more officials. We had to have longer events. Like, so there's always, you know, things that come up when you're trying to introduce, you know, a gender, a race, or whatever into sport. But yeah, trying to get that decathlon record, but then also kind of focusing, you know, on the hep, because that's where I'll get most of the opportunity right now. Even though like Thorpe Cup, I mentioned it last year and it looked like it was going to happen this year before COVID and whatever, they were actually going to essentially let me do the women's decathlon at the Thorpe Cup. And it would be like the first time it was ever an international women's decathlon event.
Wow.
So there are like movements for that. So I'm still focusing on the hep, but it's a lot of decathlon training, and sometimes I'll do a heptathlon.
Very cool.
I'm curious what the progression looked like, right? So you mentioned you got into track and field pretty late in high school. I mean, people tell me they get into it late and it's, you know, they're a sophomore or something like that, but you really were much later than that. So what, just from a numbers perspective, like what did you do that qualified you for Division I, you know what I mean, track program as a senior in high school? Just like, you know, where'd you start to get to where you are now? I know what your marks are now, but where do those start?
So when I started, I was a pretty good long jumper and I was a pretty good high jumper. I think I high jumped 5'7" in high school and I long jumped a little over 19 feet. So those were my good events because like that was basketball, right? Going up and jumping and whatever. And I was not a good 800 runner or anything, but I think I scored a 4,800 right before I came to college. I was like a 27,200 girl. I think I ran like 15 seconds in the 100 hurdles, but I just had really no experience. And I jumped from having never done one to 4,800 points. And I think just not having many training years, but being very versatile is kind of what drew colleges to me. Cause even javelin, you know, my dad was like, it's softball, center field, home plate, go. Like done, you know? So just kind of not having that much experience, but jumping so fast, I think is what kind of had colleges interested.
Sure. And then maybe to follow up on that, Andy, what do you, you know, I coach these events too, and I kind of have an idea of what we're, you know, which, because very few people come to you like she did, having actually competed in a full, you know, combined event, right? So what are you looking for, you know, and all those kids that haven't done that, but you say, hey, that's something they could do. What flips that switch for you?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, like you, a lot of it starts with the mentality, right? They have to be hungry. They have to be humble and willing to learn. I mean, you know how it is. They got a vent that just sucks and is falling apart. Well, they can't mentally let the wheels fall off. They have to, you know, embrace it and challenge it and keep going after it. And I find a lot of it, especially, you know, if you're at a mid-major conference, I think if you've got the mentality and work ethic, like, you can become conference scorer.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's, I think that's one of the challenges with the women's decathlon. I mean, the big reason that Jordan got into it is because, I mean, I can develop her into a scorer in the discus, in the shot, but I think she finished runner-up in the conference championship in the shot put.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, you know, she's able to score in those events, and then, I mean, obviously she scored in pole vault. She'd win long jump. I mean, score at the top of the high jump. I mean, just all these different areas. So, you know, it opened up the door to do the decathlon just because she could score in all the individuals. The reason I was initially hesitant to it was just because, you know, there wasn't the, you know, now there's a women's national championship for the decathlon that, you know, Becca Peters has put on with Pole Vault Power. So there's a little bit more opportunities happening for it, and there's a little bit more drive for it to happen. But, you know, when Jordan was first interested, and there wasn't really any meets, obviously, you know, you can't do it at USA's, you can't do it at NCAA's, you can't do it at conference. So, like, why are we going to do it? But I know there's definitely an interest for women. You know, there's a lot of women that would like to do it. But why are you going to train for it if you have so few opportunities? And that's where I think it's great if we can have more opportunities. But, you know, as far as kind of recruiting or looking at the athletes, that, you know, I think looking at versatility, one of the things that Jordan didn't mention, maybe she doesn't know, but one of the things that caught my attention about her being a heptathlete is at AAU, her senior year, she threw, I forget exactly what it was between like 1180 and 1240 in the shot put.
It was 1188.
Okay, 1188. So, you know, for a senior girl, I mean, she was probably won the shot put by like 2-3 meters at that meet. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, this girl, she can long jump, you know, approximately 19 feet. She can high jump. I'm pretty sure it was 5'6" out of high school. And she can throw. Like, she's got some tools. Yeah. She's slow as dirt, but she's got some tools.
Right.
Amen.
Jordan, I have a question for you. I'm looking at your statistics on TFERS, and you've thrown a hammer. Is this correct?
Yeah. I did that one time because Andy thought I might have to at conference to score some points, but then I don't even remember what it was. Maybe you do, Andy, that made me not have to do it that year, but they thought I was going to. So Andy was like, well, do you want to come try to learn this so you can throw it at least far enough to get us maybe 1 point? And I was like, sure. And then he made me throw it one time at Georgia Tech, and that was the end of my hammer throwing career.
Well, you pretty much cover almost every event. Do you have a favorite event? I know this is a question that every multi-athlete gets asked. What's your favorite?
Yeah, it's pretty much just not the 800. Like, I hate that race. I don't know why women got the 800. The 1500 is so much better. And all the decathletes were trying to freak me out. And they're like, you're going to hate it. Like, we're going to come across the line at 700 meters and you're going to wish you were dead and all this stuff. And I was like, what is wrong with you all? Like, I was just straight chilling. I was like, it's just your brain. Like, your legs can keep up at this pace. Like, you just got to keep mentally in it. And I got done. I was like, you all lied to me. The 800 is so much worse.
How do you get through the 800, especially somebody who is, as Andy said, slow as molasses?
With a lot of struggle. It's not pretty. I run a 219. That's my PR. And I pretty much whatever my, like, I don't think I've run slower than like a 222 or a 223 in a long time. But like 219, like 220 is pretty much very consistently where I'll end up. And yeah, like, it's gotten better, especially this year. So part of the reason I have loved COVID and looked on the bright side of life is because just being thrown into the heptathlon from the get-go, like, there wasn't much time to work on things that I'm weak in. So it's like, you're slow as dirt, but we're going to practice this once a week for the rest of your life, you know? So like, I, you know, with COVID, I was like, Andy, I need help with javelin and I need to run faster. And he was like, bet, we're going to do those things a lot then. So just getting to do that sprint training stuff's been great. But yeah, the 800, it's like, it's not fun to watch. Don't ever watch me run an 800.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I think, like, maybe what, you know, and of course I know a little bit of what you guys have been doing, but if you could kind of delve into how training has changed since COVID, you know, not as much access to facilities, things like that. How have you had to be creative?
Well, there's a shot put and discus circle drawn on the sidewalk at the field of the neighborhood. So we threw into the open field. I've done a lot of javelin throwing, freaking out our neighbors because I'm just walking around the field throwing a spear. So that's been most of my javelin training. I've been throwing rocks out of a bucket. I have a power clean bar and some bumper plates in my driveway and been doing lots of rate of force development work with power clean stuff. But yeah, I mean, for a while there, like it was very creative. There was a ladder in the living room with a broom going through it. So I could hold on to the broom and like pretend to throw javelin with a weight.
You ever break the broom?
No, I did not. It was a metal handle.
Okay. There you go. I was thinking wood, honestly. So I just didn't know.
That would have been funny.
That would have been great. So you have to be creative. Okay, if you've done all that stuff, have you done any running to work on the slopes, this, you know, being the slow ass?
Yeah. So I did a lot of just sprint mechanic work out in the street in the neighborhood. And then, you know, spiking up and getting on the university track has been okay. Like, I can't do any event stuff there, but, you know, people can go out there and walk or whatever. So I can go spike up and sprint out there. But yeah, I've been working on that slow as molasses thing for sure. Most of my run training was like tracing a goat through at midnight through the woods, trying to catch it when it escaped. And so like, even when I started track, I can remember my mom being like, okay, you're going to stay in your lane. You're going to go all the way around the track. Like, do you understand that? I'm like, yes. And I don't have to tackle anything at the end. I have shoes on. It's not raining. It's daylight. I'm pretty sure this will be easy. So it's been great to do this training.
Glad you don't have to chase any goats around the track anymore. I mean,
me too.
The Rio Grande Valley, you never know what's going to show up on the track, but, you know.
Is goat chasing effective?
Catching chickens is really good agility training. Really good cut step, you know, fast.
You grew up on a farm, so.
100%.
I guess you haven't guessed that yet.
Yeah. So, hey, Andy, one thing I would like to get your take on, and we don't talk a ton of training here, but I think it'd be kind of interesting, and you know, talking about Jordan running the 800 and things like that, is how you build work capacity. Because like I think we're pretty close to the same philosophy, and I'm just so impressed with what you do with the multi-eventers and how you build work capacity. If you could maybe go into that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love training design. You know, I'd be more of a chess player than a checkers player. And so I think that's one of the things that I love about the sport is trying to design training and trying to figure out the shortest road to Rome, right? The most direct road. So, you know, with that, I really kind of changed how I do things every year as I try to, you know, just evaluate what you did in the past and what worked well and maybe didn't work well and what we need to improve on. And so, you know, this year, obviously, just with COVID and everything's been unlike anything else. But this year is a little bit different than your question. But, you know, a lot with combined eventers, I find a lot of the building of work capacity is just done through our by demand long training sessions. I mean, if we have to learn 10 events and we get 5 to 6 days a week to do it, you know, it's those sessions get long. And I think just the long sessions build a lot of that work capacity. As we know, you know, the whole time you're recovering from anaerobic work, it's an aerobic process. So we do, you know, very little or basically no aerobic training, at least not with the intent of aerobic training. We're doing intent of other things and we're getting aerobic benefits. But I think, you know, through the volume of both event work, but I also try to do a lot of general strength work, hurdle mobility, injury prevention circuits, a lot of prophylactic work, barefoot work, you know, just all kinds of different things. And in order to make them more athletic, more coordinated, more balanced, more flexible, more mobile, just, you know, in trying to get everything in, like I say, the sessions get long, the weeks get long. So it's the balance then, you know, of not burning them out mentally. But I think that really kind of builds the work capacity as well as getting, you know, the requisite number of repetitions of the various event work. Gets it. But obviously we're doing, you know, specific run training. And that's one of the things that I've tried to do with Jordan a lot this year. And I think I actually overdid it. We were doing a lot of acceleration development and speed development work. I did more block training this year, really. Usually, especially with the combined events, you know, it's difficult or, you know, maybe not the best to do block training, but especially at the beginning of COVID, we're doing block where it's basically throws and speed. And that was it because we didn't have access to a pole vault pit and a high jump pit and a long jump pit. So we're literally doing acceleration development and speed development in the street in front of the house, and I'd have the measuring wheel and put out some cones and we'd get it done. And then, like you said, we'd go over to the field and we'd be working on the throws, you know, on the kind of the general days, and we'd come back over the driveway. And if it was a neural day, we'd be doing the weightlifting in the driveway. And if it was a general day, we'd be doing med ball and general strength in the driveway. So, you know, we're able to get it done with more block training, but in doing the block training, I think that I didn't give her enough kind of neural recovery. Energy system wise, she was just fine, you know, hanging on. But we were able to go to a meet actually last week and do a 400 and the hurdles and the long jump and kind of test out where we're at. And both her and Lindsay, you know, were feeling kind of fried, and they didn't do as well in the 400 or the hurdles. But then Jordan opened her first jump with, you know, 626, which whatever that is, 21 or something, 20 feet high, 20 feet eight. Which obviously the tools are there, but I think, you know, I just need to back her off. You know, the block training has a toll, right? And I think I needed to unload the nervous system a little bit more because she's a little bit taxed there. But then also with that, you know, it is energy system, but we've been doing a lot of race modeling, kind of the speed side of the 400 and of the 800, and setting up the beginning of the race correctly and forcing her to really get out aggressively. So that as that fitness comes into place and the rest comes into place, you know, then she'll be able to finish the races as we want. But again, that's pretty demanding training, you know, kind of doing at race pace, you know, in practice, you know, is essentially a neural demand as well. And I think that I've just got them a little bit fried and back them off a little bit, and then hopefully we'll be ready to pop.
Well, we have done a lot of stuff, you know, with like things at race pace, things that, you know, full speed efforts, like 250, you know, where we're basically just blasting that 250. And then we have super short rest before, you know, 150, super short rest, and then 100. And there's a lot of things we've done, you know, with speed development and speed endurance and different things like that over the, you know, past however many weeks with our block training. But that's one of the things I think that's hard too, coming from a just kind of, you know, gritted out sort of thing. Like my dad has this saying where like when we're running and he'll just be like, snot bubbles, which means whatever you're doing, you should be trying so hard that you have physical snot bubbles coming out of your face. And like, that's kind of how I am. I'm like, just grit it, just get it harder. Just like, but speed training, obviously that's the opposite. And it's not something that you can just go, 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 go on your nervous system like you can on your endocrine system. So I think that's something, you know, too, even coming from college into pro, like there's a lot of just developing you have to do when you're young. Like you have to get that mental toughness. You have to be able to just kind of grit it out. A lot of times working harder is just going to make you better. But then when you start going into pro and it starts getting a little more dialed in and you're having to do things with longer rest, well, or, you know, whatever, you don't feel like you're working as hard anymore. So you want to keep going and you want to keep giving more, but now that you're closer to your full potential, you almost have to kind of like back off and do the type of training that isn't just work hard all the time.
Well, Andy, actually, we'd asked Andy that question. I think this worked perfectly into what you're just talking about, Jordan. What are some of the things, I mean, you talk about training differently instead of more intensity, more strength work. What are some of the biggest challenges you found going from, I mean, you're freshly out of college, essentially going from being a collegiate athlete to now being a pro athlete, and especially now in a completely new setting?
Just training-wise?
Or just in general. I mean, because now, as we've talked before, you don't have half of the modules you used to have. You know, you go from having at least a team around you to, I mean, now you've got two or three, but you used to have, and I don't know how big Kennesaw was, 60, 70 kids, whatever the case might be. So talk a little bit about what the transitions were and what the issues you found. Was there any challenges that you found? Like, oh, shit, maybe I can't do this. Or no, was it always been – because you have a hell of a lot of grit. I think nobody on this podcast could ever doubt that. So it's, you're going to make this happen, but what did you ever doubt that you could do this? Did you ever doubt that the pro thing's going to work? You know?
I mean, not really, honestly. Like, I think everyone, you know, can get a little self-conscious when you're not doing well, when you're not whatever. But, like, for the most part, I was just, like, you know, going to beat the crap out of it, whatever it was. Like, I was like, this isn't working. Well, that sucks, because I'm gonna make it work. Like, it just, it's never been like something where it's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do it. It's like, well, apparently I'm doing something wrong and I'm going to fix this. Like, it's never been, you know, quite a I can't do this thing. It's just I need to figure this out. But yeah, like, it's very different, you know, going from being paid to run to having to pay to run or being paid to go work out in the morning versus having to pay to go work out in the morning. That's definitely been, you know, a big transition. And, you know, things with work, like you can't go get, you know, just a regular 9-to-5 job unless you just want to die and have a trash training session. So finding jobs that are flexible, you know, is kind of hard. Working with sponsors is something that else that's a little bit difficult, you know, just, and even with the women's decathlon, because a lot of people, you know, they're like, that's great, that's amazing, but we're not going to see you at Worlds. You know what I mean? So especially since that's kind of my discipline, like I love the heptathlon, but really I don't even necessarily consider myself a heptathlete any more than the guys would consider themselves a heptathlete when they do the heptathlon indoor. It's like, yeah, I do it. Yeah, I kind of train for it, but like, it's not, I do the heptathlon and I'm like, I'm missing events. Like I haven't gotten to do like almost half the stuff that I train for. So it's, you know, it's a little bit difficult there with sponsors and going post in such a weird event. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, the healthcare, the chiropractic, that kind of stuff. The team wasn't as big a deal to me because it's not like I was really ever on a 4x4 and I, you know, it wasn't like I ever had that kind of team aspect. And yeah, being a combined eventer, you know, you had other combined eventers with you, but especially like a conference, you know, it's not like you have your whole team out there cheering for you, you know, at the, during the heptathlon or anything. Everyone's at home because they are the hotel or whatever, because their event's later. So it wasn't super different for me, frankly, on that aspect, but the rest of it has been a little bit of a challenge.
Well, I can tell you one of the biggest challenges for Jordan going pro was that she...
Here it comes.
Well, I mentioned, you know, as the engine gets bigger, you can tear up the tires more easily, right? So in the same way that we periodized training over a year, and as we get late in the year towards the championships, like we start decreasing the volume of training, right? At the expense or for the sake of being able to do more quality of training. So as we're trying to do more quality of training with her or getting later in her career, the volume has to come down a little bit. And she has such that grit and snot bubble mentality that she's like, let me do more. And I'm like, no, back up. You need to rest more. Yeah, we'd like to do more, but your body's not gonna be able to handle more. If we give you more here, we're gonna have to take something away from over here because you can only handle so much at this quality, this intensity. So with her mentality of let's work harder, you know, that's, I think, been one of her challenges is like, why do you keep on stopping me?
Yep.
Andy, how do you balance that? Because I know you coach many different athletes and there are athletes that, you know, you kind of got to let the horses run a little bit so they feel, you know, they feel ready to go. And then others, you do have to back off depending on where they are in their career. How do you balance that? How do you look at that?
Well, I think that's largely the psychology part or the art form, you know, of being a coach, obviously. You know, and some of them, like, it's, I think it's a little bit easier with a professional athlete to listen to them, right? To a degree. I listen to Jordan a bit, but sometimes I need to still pull her back because I understand what's going on. But, you know, I guess more so with the post-collegiates, they're going to be intrinsically motivated, right? So if they say, you know, I feel like I need to back off, I need to dial down, I need a day off or whatever, I'm going to listen without hesitation. But if a freshman says, I need to, you know, to back off, I'm working too hard or whatever, it's like, no, you don't even know what hard work is yet. So I think there is, you know, getting to know the athlete, you know, the individual athlete, you know, are they that person that wants to just never stop working, or are they the person who you need to kind of push forward a little bit, you know, is definitely part of that challenge. And then that can be a challenge, you know, in a group setting, if, you know, you need to shut somebody down, but somebody needs to keep on working and getting them to have the right mentality. Like, you know, this is a reward. It's a privilege. You get to keep on working. Whereas they have to stop. They don't get to do more. You know, they don't have the opportunity to get better. They just need to go rest now. So I think it's a lot of it just how you frame it for the athlete.
Yeah, that's the worst. Cause I'm a one more rep person. I'm like, one more jump, just one more throw, just one more sprint. Just let me try it one more time. No.
Jordan, I had a question. What's kind of your hope or vision, or what would you like to see happen with the women's decathlon going forward?
I mean, I would love for it to be an actual, you know, we had USATF sanctioned, but I would love for it to be like an actual USATF event because for so many reasons, but I would love for that to happen. I would love for it to get recognized by the Olympic Committee, because there's a lot of reasons, you know, that, again, that people can come up with for why it shouldn't happen. But frankly, I don't think that they're anything that's not worth overcoming to let women have the opportunity to do a sport they love and that they're good at. So I would love to see it progress. It's picked up in other countries. Like there's some girls breaking records in, I think it was Belgium. A girl just broke like the U20 and country record. And there's just so much momentum for it. You know, women have been doing this since the 70s. And yet they're still getting told like, oh no, you don't get to do that. That's just for the guys, you know? And even at, you know, US champs, like admittedly, I had a little bit of a breakdown because like after day one, I was with Solomon Simmons, you know, and Solomon Simmons is off doing the deck and I'm doing the heptathlon after having just done a deck like a couple weeks ago. And I loved it. It's what I've been training for. Like it was like, the, you know, it was this huge culmination of years of work that I finally got to put out there. And, you know, Solomon's out there doing the decathlon. And like the only thing that was ever different between mine and Solomon's training is our like hard run days at the end of the week. Like mine was a little bit more 800 oriented and his was 1500 oriented. But other than that, like it was all the same. And so I had a little bit of a breakdown after day one. And I was like, Solomon, like, you are out here getting to do what we train for. Like you're out here getting to do what you love. I do the same workouts as you every day. I pole vault, I discus, I do all this stuff. And yet I'm getting told that because I was born without a penis, I don't get to do what I love, you know? And that's like, it's really like brutal, but you know, and like he was talking to me a little bit about it. And I was like, you know, we live in a world where like, it's very, you know, it's wrong for, you know, us to be, you know, sexist or racist or anything like that, which is perfect. Like we don't want anybody being sexist or racist. I was like, but imagine how you would feel if they said, you know what, Solomon, you're black. You don't get to do the decathlon. Like you were born black. So like, you don't get to do this anymore. Like there would be an insane uproar if we were that racist in the decathlon, but we can be just as sexist and barely anybody cares. And so like, there's so many women that would love this opportunity that think it would be great. And yet like, we just kind of get shoved on the back burner because it doesn't get considered sexist. So I would love to see that barrier broken in the women's decathlon.
Do you have any idea?
You guys go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think we have a voice. I mean, I'm with you, you know, like that was passionate and well thought out. And I mean, I agree with you 100%. To me, the fact that you've got men and women doing two different things, you know, in one particular event on the track is kind of crazy. And it would be awesome to see that become more prevalent and maybe even someday replace it. But shoot, I hope you keep talking to people that can make those kind of decisions because I don't know, if they don't buy into that, they're not paying attention. So.
Well, and one of the cool things was Rex Harvey, who was the chair of Masters track and field for USATF. He had said that women's triple jump and I think it was women's steeplechase, their pole vault, had started in Masters track and field. And then it went into, you know, then it went from there into everything else.
Sure.
You know, national championships, Olympics, whatever, whatever. And they were planning this year to start the women's decathlon in Masters. Obviously everything, you know, shut down with COVID, but I really hope that that continues and goes through next year. Because if they get that going, and then, you know, like I say, with Becca Peters, you know, through pole vault power, getting kind of the women's decathlon national championship going, I think we could kind of get some steam and you know, something to make it happen. But I mean, you know how it is. It's difficult. If you don't have the NCAA championships, you know, how many people are going to teach, you know, young women how to do it?
Right.
Where's the hesitation? Where's the hesitation? Maybe both of you can provide some insight. I'm trying to get educated on where's the hesitation from moving.
Well,
to the
people don't want to change. but I mean, it's right. If I'm not saying anything about Petros, but Petros has a great heptathlon program, right, at UGA. So if he's having a lot of success with the heptathlon and he's scoring a lot of points at NCAA championships and he's getting bonuses for doing well there, why would he want to change what's working well for him? And a lot of the current heptathletes, obviously the heptathlon's working well for them. So a lot of the best heptathletes, I'm not calling anybody, you know, by name. It could be the current heptathletes of today or current heptathletes of 10 years ago. I mean, if they're making their bread and butter on being a professional heptathlete, they're going to be like, no, I don't want you to switch it to decathlon because I'm getting paid by doing this. Mm-hmm. So I think the people that are having success with the status quo don't want change to happen for, I guess, fear basically that they might lose out on something. I think another aspect is that in the US, I mean, just look at our sprints, right? We have a lot of fast athletes, a lot of speed power athletes. And if you look at the heptathlon, a lot of the heptathletes, you look at their shot putting their javelin and it's terrible, but their 200 is rocking. Their hurdles are world class compared to open hurdlers. You know, they can jump, you know, because they got some speed. Their long jump is pretty solid. Their high jump is good, but they're just, they're these kind of light speed power athletes. And if you add in, you know, the technical event of the pole vault and the technical event of the discus, they might not be the same as, it's going to be a lot more difficult, right? It's going to take more time. It's going to take more effort. It's going to take a little more dedication, a lot more teaching. It's going to take more coaching. So I think that, you know, a lot of people is like, well, the hep's easier. It's easier to have success. We have a lot of U.S. athletes that are kind of wired this way. So let's keep it that way. Whereas, you know, personally, I like the decathlon because I think it is more of a challenge. And, you know, I think you have to be a little more versatile. So, but I think that those are some of the things that hold it back. Obviously, there's other arguments of, you know, developing countries that can't, don't have a pole vault pit or pole vault poles or whatever, which, I mean, my kind of thought there is that, well, then they don't have the men's decathlon either. So I don't know that that's necessarily an argument. And then the other one is, you know, just the history of the women's heptathlon and the records of the women's heptathlon. And obviously that's fantastic, but it also used to be the women's pentathlon and they fought and got that changed, you know, to the heptathlon. And personally, I think it's, you know, time to continue to evolve to that, you know, level of equality where the women do the deck. And I don't think we throw away the heptathlon all at once. You know, have some sort of bleeding process. But I would like to see it, you know, obviously move forward, you know, where the women are doing the deck as well as the men.
Well, and I think there's also hesitation, right? Because like you said, there's women that are really good at, you know, the heptathlon, so they don't want it to change. But my mom, you know, she can remember when her cousins in Iowa were still playing half court basketball. And they talked to her and they're like, you played basketball like the boys? Like what? And, you know, and that was incredible to them. But at the same time, they didn't necessarily want it to change because they were like, I'm a defensive player. Like, I don't want to have to learn offense. You know, so we think of like women's basketball going from half court to full court is like this amazing progression in women's sports now. But even back then, there were women that were like, no, I don't want to learn defense. I don't want to learn run back and forth down the court. Like, I have to learn more. That takes more time. That takes more energy. So like, there's always somebody that's not even going to like the change that much, right? And so even when, you know, we say, oh, it's tradition or whatever of the women's heptathlon, like, yeah, it's great. Yeah, there's awesome things that people have done. Jackie Jordan Kersee freaking blew it out of the water. Like, she would have probably been a bomb deck, you know? Like, I think that, you know, there's women that have done awesome things. And, you know, I've even had people tell me a lot of times, you know, they're like, oh, like, that's really good, you know, that you're doing it. But like the heptathlon, just because you're a heptathlete doesn't mean that you're any less of an athlete. Like Jackie Jordan Kersee isn't less of an athlete than Ashton Eaton or whatever. I'm like, yeah, like I don't think that the 100 meter dash guy is any less of an athlete than the 10K guy. They're just different. Like it's not, you know, about being less or more of an athlete. It's not even necessarily about the tradition. Like if we kept tradition, there would be a lot of things still wrong with this country. I wouldn't be able to vote. Like lots of people wouldn't be free. Like there's lots of things. Like, well, I just don't like the tradition of women not voting. Like you all are too emotional and you just might not be able to make a rational decision come voting day. Like that doesn't happen. So, like, I don't really understand that argument because it seems stupid to me because nowhere else in the world do we keep that argument. Like, well, I just like the tradition. Well, tradition sucks sometimes, so.
Jordan, I got a question for you. You are obviously a powerful voice in this movement towards pushing the heptathlon to the decathlon. But what advice would you give to maybe younger athletes or maybe young women that are thinking about becoming multis, whether it be in high school or in college, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, I feel like that would depend a little bit on each person, like what their goals are in track and field. Like, is your goal just to go get a scholarship? Is your goal just to do track and field because you love it? Is your goal, you know, everybody goes in with a different thought process on, you know, the heptathlon or the decathlon. And there's not even a lot of them that do it in high school. So some of the ones that are doing it in high school, like I've had a ton of girls and even moms message me like videos of their little girl long jumping or something. And they're like, I hope because of you, like one day she'll be able to do the decathlon. Like, you know, like, so I think that, you know, it's just kind of what you want to, you know, accomplish. So like, if you want to go into the multis, like if you want to be, you know, an awesome multi, like let's make you even more versatile. You know what I mean? Like, let's get you to be even more athletic. Let's get you, because there are some things, you know, like even moving into rotational shot put this year, that has been so much easier because I already know discus. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many things about this. Like, it's fun. Like, pole vault is fun. You know, so like, there's a lot of things I think that young girls could do to even just start training for the deck. And even if you never end up doing a decathlon, like, I think that that type of training, just that not overusing muscles, getting to learn new things, getting to have fun, like, it can keep you a little fresh. You know, I think that it's a great thing for young girls to be practicing for the decathlon, even if they don't necessarily do it.
No, I absolutely love that. I think that's great. So what, and you've got an unbelievable platform that you can use to help push this kind of stuff forward. And if we can help, we'll all help, especially distance coaches and multis or not. We need to be able to push the decathlon forward and everything that we do. It's going to take a little more work, but guess what? So does everything good. You know, a little more grit, a little more determination, one more rep is always one of those things.
Exactly.
Everything. What's next? You mentioned you had a meet last weekend. You did a couple of things, a 400 and some long jump. Are you going to do another one, or have you guys shut it down?
No, I haven't shut it down. I'm going to be going for about a year straight just to do the women's decathlon October 3rd and 4th. It's going to be in Marble Falls, just a little bit outside of Austin. Frankly, okay, it might not even go that well, just because we have been doing so much block training. We have been doing so much, you know, speed work, and we've been focusing on all these things. So it should, you know, theoretically go well, but just, you know, you can't race into shape, but competition is such a big part of, you know, the training design of a year. And having only one peak and one multi, like, I don't necessarily expect it to go amazing, having be my first, basically my first meet of the year. Yeah. But it should be fun.
Would you know what the next competition is going to be for you at all?
Just October 3rd and 4th. For that one,
just the next October 3rd and 4th. Okay. I apologize if I missed something in there. It's only just because you never know what things pop up and out of nowhere, that kind of thing. But that's the big one for you. Man, that's awesome. And again, I would say it again. I think you heard it from the gentleman on here, the panel. You've got an opportunity to use the platform. I'm starting to see some kids, I can't remember who it was, and I was just looking for it originally, and I can't find it, but I know some people are pushing for having a clean sport and having another sport of another voice for the professional track and field athletes, and try and get a group started, almost if anything, a union started, to make sure that you guys are taking care and better. I'm missing the name of it, and I completely apologize. But I think it's something that should happen, and use the platform to move the decathlon forward. There's no reason. I know we would all help out and do whatever we can do with that kind of stuff. But thank you, Andy. I want to thank you for being on the podcast. Some unbelievable conversation and some in-depth knowledge I had never thought about before. And Jordan, I love the passion, the grit that you show with this kind of stuff. And you pretty much have put you in a dogfight, and I'm pretty sure you're going to come out dragging everybody behind you. I would be out there, that's for sure. And I love that. And that's one thing as us coaches, that if we find that in an athlete, we become attached to it, because it is something absolutely special. So I encourage you to keep going after it. Use your platform, whatever you can do to get this big, because obviously you've got a lot of big goals, and there's no reason to shy away from it. But to everybody else listening, I want to thank you for your time. We know it's valuable. We know that you've got a lot of choices in podcasts. Hopefully we're not the only one, but hopefully we provide at least some entertainment on your run, your walk. If you're sitting back in the woods, just sit back listening and enjoying yourself, or enjoying a cup of coffee, whatever you might be doing. We hope you took something from this. I absolutely did. I learned a ton today. But we hope that you took something from this. If you like it, leave us a review on Apple. Share us on Spotify. Share it on your friends' social media. As we all know, the best form of advertisement is, referrals. And so share it everywhere you can share it. Make sure your friends listen to it. Get them excited. Get the mom and dads that have, you know, that are watching you jump and do that stuff. Let them listen to it. So it's a great, great opportunity. But we're going to try and do better again next week. We thank everybody for their time, and we look forward to seeing you guys on the flip side. So thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks. We'll see you.